My name is Bill Swank, and on behalf of my fellow panelists, Carlos Bauer and Angus McFarland, we'd like to welcome you to what is listed as your program as the early California baseball panel. But we're actually going to be, our panel is actually the pre-1957 baseball, two words, in California panel. And for you disciples of Frederick Jackson Turner, the California baseball frontier closed in 1957. We'd like to thank Scott Busch, the CEO of Sabre, for the opportunity to appear at your conference, and also local Sabre president Tom Larwin for all his help. And we'd also like to acknowledge some fellow historians. They're going to be on California baseball alphabetically: Dick Beveridge, Dick Dobbins, Mark McRae, Doug McWilliams, Alan O'Connor, John Spaulding, and Galen White. Thank you. Is Dick Beveridge here by any chance? Okay, I thought maybe that was him applauding. I want to confess that when I was younger, I didn't like it when older authors would read excerpts from their books at signings. But now that I'm older, I can understand why they did it. So I apologize, but I'm going to be doing some reading here. It keeps me focused, and we've got a short time to fire some fastballs at you. Okay, I'd like to see a show of hands of people who are from the East or the Midwest. A lot of you. Okay. I'd like to see a show of hands of people who think California is different. And it's okay for Californians to raise their hands. Okay. Well, you've been here a few days. We're glad you're in San Diego, and we are different. Now, in San Diego, our residents complain when it gets over 70 degrees. And they complain when it's under 70. So on behalf of the city of San Diego, I'd like to apologize for the last 3 days. It was 70 degrees on Wednesday, but it was 73 on Thursday and Friday, and they say it could get up to 77 today, so we're sorry. Weather is very important for baseball in California. Because of the good weather that we enjoy in this state, baseball initially, and still is, was played year-round, but it was primarily a winter game in the 19th century and early 20th century. And the biggest match game of the year was played on Thanksgiving Day or Christmas Day or New Year's Day. There were over 100 years ago, California teams had colorful names like the San Jose Prune Pickers, the Fresno Raisin Eaters, the Stockton Poppies, the Oakland Haberdashers, and who can forget the Los Angeles Lulus, the Merced Fig Growers, the Watsonville Hayseeds, the San Francisco Distillers, and the classy Oakland Dudes. Now, some cities have terrible names for their teams. Thank you. In the early 1900s, the San Diego Union referred to our local team as the Bay and Climate Boys. That embarrassingly awkward name was difficult to fit in a headline, and it was difficult to sew on a baseball blouse as well. And so we admit that the early San Diego sports writers were not known as clever wordsmiths. Now, 1957, that may have been a magic year in Major League Baseball because it arrived in California, but really it arrived 110 years earlier. And the evolution of the game was quite different than in the East and the Midwest. A big problem was the long distances between major cities. Many localized leagues were formed, and major leagues were very, very far away. And they were derisively known as the Eastern Leagues. And for many in California, they were so far away, they didn't even know they existed. And as far as Easterners are concerned, California and California baseball didn't exist. And I think that may still be true, especially those of you that live in the East and you don't know what happened in San Diego or on the West Coast. We get the San Diego Union Tribune, Last night's game, they don't even have the damn box score in it. That's right, because it's printed up in L.A. Okay. What happened is that, you know, you've heard about all the crying there was in Brooklyn when the Dodgers left. Well, there was crying out in the West Coast, too. But you don't hear about that. But those of you that lived in California back in 57 know that that the Pacific Coast League, they were worried it was going to die. The landscape was changed forever, and old baseball fans, and you look like a bunch of old baseball fans, you know you don't like change. When my book was Baseball in San Diego from the Plaza of the Padres was published in 2005, I specifically noted that my unpublished friend Angus McFarland, down at the end, had a theory about soldiers from New York bringing baseball to the San Francisco Bay Area during the Mexican War. And in that book, I referred to Angus as a baseball prehistorian, but baseball archaeologist might have been a more accurate description. Angus is going to talk about digging up the earliest evidence of baseball in California.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill. That's my son and me. I'm on the left, he's on the right. This is the largest group I've spoken in front of, so if you'll indulge me for a moment, I'm going to address all of you so that I can relax. Let's say speak, imagine everybody being naked. So, okay, welcome to San Diego, where California began, and welcome to San Diego, where California baseball began. Okay, Alexander Cartwright's Hall of Fame plaque, in the third line from the bottom, credits him with carrying baseball to the Pacific Coast, meaning California. I'll show that simply isn't true. But if not Cartwright, then who? Who did carry baseball to the Pacific Coast, meaning California? They say it takes a village to raise a child. In this case, it took a military battalion to introduce baseball to California. In 1846, President Polk declared an unlosable war against Mexico to justify seizing California. But there was no military force in California to capture and control the territory. In a complicated arrangement between President Polk and the Mormon Church, 500 men were organized into a military battalion for a one-year enlistment. This was the Mormon Battalion. On July 20th, 1846, they began a six-month, 2,000-mile march from Iowa to San Diego to secure Polk's prize. One of the members was 18-year-old Azariah Smith. Azariah that's his portrait later in life to the left of Alexander Cartwright's plaque. That's him later in life. His journal that he kept during the Mormon Battalion period of his life contains the equivalent of California baseball history in the beginning. He wrote, and there's a handwritten copy from his journal as well as a transcribed, easier to read script. He wrote, "We drilled as before. Through the day we play ball and amuse ourselves the best way we can." This is the earliest reference to baseball in California. This is his typical laconic style. He wasn't writing as a journalist or for history, just to note what he did. Now, although Azariah mentioned baseball only once, it wasn't a one-and-done deal for the West Coast game. While the Mormons were marching to San Diego, 770 soldiers were sailing to San Francisco from New York. This was Stevenson's regiment. After 6 months at sea, they arrived in San Francisco to fight in the Mexican-American War, arriving just after baseball's birth in San Diego. Company F of Stevenson's regiment was deployed to Santa Barbara. In the definitive book on Stevenson's regiment, it's mentioned that the men of Company F made a nuisance of themselves in Santa Barbara by playing ball in the streets. Now, my good friend Bill Swank wonders if the Company F team ever played the Mormon Battalion team for the championship of California in 1847. Azariah doesn't mention that. At the end of their one-year enlistment, the Mormons were anxious to get back home, but they didn't know where home was. When they had begun their trek to California a year before, the Mormon colony was migrating west. The Mormon battalion broke up into smaller homeward bound groups. Azariah and his group went to Sacramento, where Sutter's Fort was located, for information and for supplies. There they learned that the Mormon migration had stopped in Utah. In 1847, California wasn't a destination. Gold hadn't been discovered yet, so there were no trails over the Sierra. So for 2 weeks, Azariah and his homesick Mormon brothers bushwhacked and boulder hopped the trail over the mountains until they were intercepted by riders from Utah telling them to stay in California for a year. Azariah got a job building a sawmill for John Sutter. It was at this sawmill that Azariah was present for the discovery of gold. In his typically laconic style, Azariah wrote, "This week, Monday the 24th, Mr. Marshall found some pieces of, as we all suppose, gold." That summer, Azariah joined a group of Mormons who put family before fortune. They spent 40 days blazing a road over the Sierra. This became the preferred crossing into California for tens of thousands of gold seekers and settlers. A year later, while Azariah was at home with his family in Utah, Alexander Cartwright had left his family in New York. Now he was a California-bound, gold-seeking, baseball-carrying beneficiary of the Trans-Sierra route into California, pioneered by Azariah and his Mormon brothers, seeking the gold that Azariah had been among the first to behold, carrying baseball to a land where the Mormon battalion had played the game 2.5 years earlier, as duly noted by Azariah Smith. Thank you.
It's impossible to describe our next speaker, Carlos Bauer. In the past, it seemed like every time I checked out newspaper and microfilm down at the San Diego Library, he was already there doing research. I think of all the miles this guy put on as he drove across California, visiting small towns and searching through the old newspaper files and all the box scores he read to recreate all the league records. And he even corrects the official statistics, which hasn't always resulted in appreciation of his work. People don't like it when their errors are pointed out. There he is. He's a San Diego guy, but he's wearing a San Francisco outfit there. He's kind of confused in that one. So there you go, my friend. Take it away.
Okay. I just want to say hello to all the people I haven't seen for 20 years. And I just want to say when I came to San Diego in 1993, I was a Sabre member for a few years, since the early to mid-80s. But I returned home to San Diego in 1993, not 1893, but it seems like 1893. I had two things that I wanted to do: correct some of the records of the Pacific Coast League statistical record and fill in some of the blanks in the early. I met John Spaulding, who did a book, Always on Sunday, which is a classic, and he did the history of the California League. John wasn't a big guy on stats, so I decided to go off on a tangent and fill in the stats for the California League. Then one thing led to another. I saw other leagues and everything else. And so far, I have found 137 professional leagues in the state of California between 1878 and 1968. Additionally, there are 293 communities, and I think I've been to virtually all of them except for the ghost towns, to their libraries to dig out box scores. Bill Swank, I've been from San Diego and El Centro up to Crescent City and Doris, California, up on the border with Oregon, and I was surprised. There was as few as one league. There were years where there was only one league in California, because in the early years in the 19th century, California was very dependent on the economy. So when California went into the tank, baseball ended. Like the California League ended on July 14th, 1893. And it was several years before they had another state league, California League. The extent I have found so far, I've documented 8,864 players who played professional baseball in the state in those years. I'm only up through the years up through the dead ball era of 1918. So I still have the golden age of the 20s and 30s to do, and I think I'll double the number of players. Now, how good were these leagues, and how long did these leagues last? Well, you think, well, maybe they only lasted a couple of years. Not true. The San Joaquin Valley League was off and on from 1888 to 1946. The Placer Nevada League played from 1923 up through 1968, and that was the last league of the independent ball in the state until the independent leagues came back with the Golden League and another couple of leagues in the Sacramento Valley League, which was famous, began in 1912 and played until 1956. After World War II, the leagues were being eaten up by organized baseball that put in the Far West League, leagues that you've heard about, which Bill Weiss, who statistician of all those leagues, called the Far Worst League. Because when he got the box scores, they were horrible, and he had a hard time putting together the statistics for the guides for that. Additionally, the Sunset League, which some of you may have heard about, that played in the early league, other leagues that came in there in the late 40s and early 50s. The California League came back after World War II. The Organized Baseball California League. Anyway, some other leagues besides that were the Humboldt County League / Redwood League, began in 1878 and went through 1957 with almost continuous baseball, except for the Warriors, World War I and World War II. Now, the San Joaquin Valley League is interesting because it played through World War II, incorporating, and I haven't done a lot of research on that, but that's next on my project. They played in World War II, and they had military teams in there. They had Hanford and Fresno, and a couple of Hammer Air Force Base teams, and another team. How good were these leagues? Well, some were better than the Pacific Coast League. John Spaulding says that makes a good argument for the 1907 and 1908 California State League was better than the Pacific Coast League for those years. The San Joaquin Valley of the early 20s, I think, was better than the Pacific Coast League. Bob Hoy, who may or may not be here today, when I showed him rosters when we were working at Cal State Fresno Library, I showed him the rosters and box scores for some of the leagues. He says, that sounds like a PCL All-Star League. Anyway, there were players in there. They recruited major leaguers like Dutch Leonard, who held the record, he may still hold the record for earned run average in the American League, was pitched 3 years there. Other players played there. One story that Bill Swank likes is the story of Sailor Stroud. In 1919, Stroud won 26 games in the Pacific Coast League. Bill Lane, who came to San Diego and was the owner of the San Diego Padres in 36, was the owner of the Salt Lake City team, and Stroud pitched for him and won 26 games. When Lane, who was notoriously cheap, figured out that he couldn't sign Stroud for 1920, he sold a contract to another famous Coast Leaguer who owned the San Francisco Seals, Charlie Graham. Well, in the meantime, Stroud signed with Hanford to pitch. And when Charlie Graham couldn't sign him, he sold the Stroud's contract to the New York Yankees. And the Hanford newspaper asked Stroud, interviewed him, "Are you going to the Yankees?" Stroud said, "What do you mean, go to the Yankees and take a cut and pay?" I mean, there was big money in the San Joaquin Valley League. And he pitched for 3 years. Dutch Leonard did the same thing. The San Joaquin Valley League had their own minor league called the Raisin Belt League. And some of you may have heard of Frank Schellenbach, who won 295 games in the Pacific Coast League. Well, Schellenbach couldn't make it in the San Joaquin Valley League and had to pitch in the Raisin Belt League in 19 and 20. Let's see. I want to say a few things about California baseball in general. There were other leagues, but the California League before in the 19th century had players who played in the league, and I just want to go through a couple of players here. It's on this card. Early players were Dave and Rube Levy, who played for 20 and 19 seasons, consecutive seasons. Hip Perrier, who was born in Paris, came as a young boy to San Francisco, and he played 15 seasons. Hugh Smith and his brother Big John, who was a major leaguer, they played 17 and 15 seasons. Charlie Sweeney played 8 seasons. He held the 19-game strikeout record for a number of years until Perry Wood won 20. There were a couple of pitchers.
Excuse me, Carlos. I got to cut in.
Okay.
You can see that this guy could talk the rest of the day and all next week. He really knows his stuff, and he's only halfway through with doing his research. Would you say you're that far into it?
I'm pretty close to the end.
I don't believe you. Now, you see my picture there? I wasn't planning on coming like this. But the bio makes reference to the fact that I'm Santa Claus. I've been Santa Claus in San Diego since 2002, Balboa Park for San Bruno Prado. How do you like my Hillerich and Bradsby candy cane? Okay, and I've used my bat playing for the House of David. How many of you heard of House of David? All right. You guys are all right, because I tell people about the House of David, they don't know anything about it. You know, it was a religious colony. They believed in leading a clean, healthy lifestyle. They were vegetarians. Obviously, I'm not. And they were barnstormers. They were biblical. They had long hair, beards. And I played for the original House of David in 2003, and I played two years after that. I'm the only Santa Claus to ever play for the House of David. And that's the leader. He confirmed that. He thanked me for doing that. There's my card. A 98-year-old catcher for the House of David, a man named Eddie Deal. He taught me the hidden ball and the beard trick. And I'd never tried it, of course, because you don't get too many opportunities to do that. And it turned out it was written up in the Chicago Tribune, because I pulled it off, and the umpire didn't know what to do. And he said I was unsportsmanlike doing it in the first place, and that it wasn't a real ball, but it was. So that's why I'm dressed the way I am today. I have fun being Santa. Okay, now to get to the important business here. San Diego is down at the end of the line, right? January 7th, 1870, article in the San Diego Union, headline, Baseball. A gentleman asks whether there is such an institution as a baseball club in San Diego. That was January 7th, 1871. This is the way we do business down here. May 7th, 1871. So it's over a year later, almost a year and a half, there's an article that says, a movement afoot to organize baseball. Now, the next day, May the 4th, 1871, was the first professional baseball game ever. And it was in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And the Kikianga somehow upset the mighty Forest City out of Cleveland, 2-0. And I think they'd lost their next 10 or 11 games, and they were done. But on the 6th, before teams could even be organized, San Diego, 18 eager ballists met at the plaza, and the first match of ball was held in San Diego. There wasn't a score. Moving on to November 26th to 28th of 1878, the Academy Baseball Club of Los Angeles sailed to San Diego aboard the SS Orizaba for a three-match Thanksgiving set against San Diego's top players. The locals swept the series. Go San Diego. 29-24, 34-9, and 35-14. Beating LA has always been very important in San Diego. But to this day, Los Angeles fans, they love to come to San Diego, but they've never taken our Padres very serious. And you probably know why. Following that contest, the ballists repaired to the Horton House, where an elegant Thanksgiving dinner awaited them. Toasts were given, songs were sung, wit and humor abounded. The Academy team was escorted to the steamer Apron by their new friends, who sent them home with three hearty cheers and a tiger. Anybody know what a tiger is? I did this with the House of David. Wasn't that exciting? Now, in the 1800s, it was a gentleman's game. You know, normal people, they couldn't afford to get on steamers and go to L.A., etc. In June of 1880, San Diego's founding father, Alonzo Horton, attended one of the games against that Orange County team. He always wore a dark suit with a long formal coat topped with a tall silk hat. A foul ball alighted on Mr. A.E. Horton's head. Never one to be nonplussed, Horton demanded that San Diego be given a score based on his miraculous catch. The umpire refused, and the crowd burst out laughing. You can tell that the sports writers didn't know that much about baseball either. Certainly Horton didn't. And the union said, three more brilliant games have never been witnessed before. They were pretty good at exaggerating. In 1888, there was a big article about the old-fashioned games used to be joyous and jocund and were always fun because they didn't like professional ball. They didn't believe in it. And also, they're a lot of cheap bastards in San Diego. Here's a sermon appeared on July the 28th, 1889. It was written by the Reverend F. R. Perkins. He warned the twin demons of baseball, gambling and drunkenness, which results in desolated homes, commercial dishonesty, theft, blasted lives, and all forms of vice and violence. So there you have it. Now, in 1890, an out-of-town promoter named Marco Hellman was praised in the newspaper for his money and his enthusiastic energy and for bringing first-class work to the San Diego Diamond. With the promise of high wages, he lured powerful Sacramento centers to play for San Diego in the Southern California Winter League. He sold stock. He leased beautiful recreation park at the end of the trolley line out at the Ostrich Farm overlooking Mission Valley, and you've never heard of it. The stands were packed. San Diego's won the first three games, but rumors began to circulate that there were financial problems. Unbeknownst, Hellman had snuck off to the Santa Fe Depot and said, I want a locomotive quick to take me to Los Angeles. Money's no object. And it was the biggest ticket the young clerk ever wrote, $500. In record time, This is from the paper. One of the noblest steeds of the Iron Cavalry of Commerce appeared on the northbound tracks, ready to carry the fallen magnate to the sanctuary of the City of Angels. Hellman didn't return for the ticket. He just disappeared in the night. And that family is still wealthy, and they still live in Pasadena. And I tried to contact them and say, hey, what the hell did you do in San Diego? And they didn't answer me. The 19th century ended with a round-robin double elimination tournament. Los Angeles, San Bernardino, and San Diego. L.A. was quickly eliminated. The San Diegos beat San Bernardino 11-10. And on New Year's Day, 1900, they rallied to beat San Bernardino and win it all 9-7. Thank you. Oh, thank you. You're aware of the devastation that was caused by the great 1906 San Francisco earthquake. The old newspapers and city records were destroyed, so it's hard to find out, you know, what was happening before then. For years, it was accepted that the first baseball game in San Francisco was played on Washington's birthday, February 22nd, 1860. In an editor's note from the volume one of the Journal of the Early Game, written by Mr. John Thorne, who was baseball's official historian, he had this to say about Angus McFarlane. The author's groundbreaking research overturns everything we thought we knew about the dawn of baseball out west. And that's my friend Angus. Take it away, pal.
Thank you, Bill. I'm going to remain seated for this portion, and those of you that I undressed who didn't put your clothes back on, please feel free to do so. Okay, now I'm going to take you to San Francisco. It's February 4th, 1851. On the lower left portion of this image, you see the headlines, the banner from the Daily Alta California with the date February 4th. And it's in the morning paper. You're reading it, get your start on the day. And there's nothing big, nothing to get excited about, except that article. That little three-line news item is the first snowflake in a veritable blizzard of baseball news in California. This is the first firsthand account of baseball since Azariah's journal entry back in 1847. Over the next 7 weeks, three newspapers will make five separate references to baseball being played in what was called the Plaza, today's Portsmouth Square. The brief so-called news items were so lacking in information that we don't know who these guys were. We'll never know. But we can make an educated guess. A month before the February 3rd game, using newspapers as the social media of the day, a call went out to expat New Yorkers in San Francisco to form a Knickerbocker Association. The first Knickerbocker meeting was about a week later, and on January 22nd, perhaps because so many ex-New Yorkers wanted to join, membership was restricted to upper-crust gentlemen only. Now, you can read in the article there on the left, it says sporting gentlemen. Well, I'll get back to that reference. Despite that gentleman-only restriction, nearly 400 to 500 transplanted sons of the Empire State met the requirement. Among the names that appeared in the newspaper reports of the Knickerbocker Association activities that month were E.A. Ebbets, Frank Turk, and Charles Case. These men were not just from New York, but they had played baseball in New York. Turk and Ebbets were members of the original New York Knickerbocker Baseball Club, and Case had been with the rival New York Nine. I found four additional baseball-playing New York Knickerbockers in and around San Francisco at this time. All of these men had social and business ties with one another in San Francisco. More New York Knickerbocker ball players, as well as other New York baseball players, may have been among the 400 to 500 rank-and-file members of the Knickerbocker Association who weren't mentioned in the newspaper articles. The association had a recording secretary who probably kept copious and detailed minutes of their meetings, which would have answered our questions about whether or not the Knickerbockers were involved in this first reference to baseball being played in San Francisco, but we'll never know. We're left with speculation. So let's speculate. Imagine you're a former Knickerbocker baseball player, but now, by virtue of being a gentleman An upper crust gentleman at that, you are also a San Francisco Knickerbocker. San Francisco, where you've become professionally or socially or politically successful, but where you haven't played baseball in a number of years. And you're not that old, you're only in your 30s. So you've attended some recent social gatherings that included former teammates, rivals from New York. After the business had been concluded of the association, you retire to the social room, you sip your brandy, you sip your whiskey, they take their magic effect upon you, work their magic, you reminisce. Yo, barkeep, whiskey with a chaser of nostalgia. The pipe and the cigar smoke are drifting lazily around the room, mingling with the fond memories, the boasting, the colored recollections of contests that took place a continent away and years ago. Now adrenaline and testosterone are fueling the discussions. Inevitably, somebody makes a fateful decision, throws down the gauntlet, the call goes out. Let's play ball. Now granted, coincidence is not causation. We don't have any hard evidence, no fingerprints, no eyewitness testimony, no DNA, about who actually played baseball in the plaza, either at this game or the subsequent other games referred to in the newspaper. But keep in mind, less than a month after the Knickerbockers were founded, which included baseball players from New York, baseball was being played in the plaza. Now, something else to consider about this picture. Less than a week before the first game, the Alta, the major paper in San Francisco, referred to a daguerreotype, this is off to the right-hand side, referred to a daguerreotype image of the plaza. There's no caption for this image, but it matches the descriptive elements in that reference. It shows the Alta office, which I've underlined. That would be the second building from the left that appears to have a flagpole coming out of it. It refers to Washington Street, which is the street fronting the buildings. And significantly, it refers to the figures in the foreground. I don't know how well you can see that from where you're seated, but the figures in the foreground, to me, look like gentlemen. They're wearing top hats, frock coats, dress trousers. Is it possible that these gentlemen, at least in my mind, they're gentlemen, are members of the Knickerbocker Association studying the plaza for a potential game next week? Thank you.
What you are witnessing is actually our first dress rehearsal for this. We've all practiced at home. We're all supposed to limit ourselves to five-minute presentations, and that hasn't worked. So I'm just going to quickly move to Carlos. He's going to talk about the Pacific Coast League, and he's done extensive research on the Pacific Coast League as well, and he's going to mention some of the great teams from 1903 on, I believe. He'll probably start earlier than that.
Well, I just want to, because this is California baseball, I made a list of what were the best teams for each city in California. Fresno played 1 year, 1906, so it was the best and worst. It had a 3.348 winning percentage, but it had some great players who all went, who became old almost immediately. They had Charlie Demon Doyle, who was the manager, but they also had George McLaughlin, Pearl Casey, Truck Egan, Walt Cartwright, Hap Hogan, Walter Dashwood, Frank Arianez, who pitched for Boston, but they all became old. So that's the first team. We'll run through this. Hollywood is the next on the alphabet, and I thought 1952 was the best Hollywood team, and then Chuck Stevens said, Carlos, no, the 1949 team was better. We had a tougher, it was a tougher league in 49, but so anyway, in 49 they had a 583, and let's see where this is. Los Angeles, of course, was the 1934 team, and the 49 team, here we go, was managed by Fred Haney, which Chuck Stevens said was a great manager. Irv Noren wasn't so happy with him, but they had Chuck Stevens on that team, Irv Noren, who hit 330 with 29 home runs. Frank Kelleher, another one, was on that team. The pitchers were Pinky Woods, who went 23-12. They had Willie Ramsdell and Gordon Malzberger on there. For LA, it had to be the 1934 team. Everybody knows that one. The team finished first, and the first was so good that they had to split the season because they were so far ahead. Jigger Stats was on that team. Marv Gudok, Jimmy Reese, Frank Demery, Gene Lillard, just everybody. Faye Thomas and Lou Garland were on that team, and Mike Maiola were the 320-game winners. But also, you have to remember that the 1956 team is the runner-up with Steve Bilko. The Missions in 1929 were the best team that they had, and they finished, they won the pennant in that year. Oakland, 1927, won the pennant, but the 1948 team with the eight old men was another great team, so it's sort of a, you know, the eight old men and Billy Martin, so, you know, was on there as a kid. For those people, the next team would be Sacramento, and I know there are a couple of people here from Sacramento. 1942 and 1937 were the two teams. I think the 1937 team was the best, but there's a good chance of people wanting the 42. In 42, you had Tony Freitas, who won 24 games. Steve Mesner was on there, who also played for the Padres. Buster Adams, etc. San Diego, I'm going to defer to Bill Swank, who can talk about them. I chose 54, which was a miracle team, but Bill has forgotten more about the Padres than I will ever know. San Francisco, let's go to San Francisco. I believe the best team was the 1925 San Francisco team, but you also had 46, 1909, and 1957 teams. So, but the 25 team had Gene Valla, Eddie Mulligan, Hal Rein, Bert Ellison, Frank Brouwer, Paul Wehner, who hit 401, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The pitching staff was Bob Geary, Ollie Mitchell, Doug McWeeny, Guy Williams. Those were their 420-game winners. And I think it was, if not as good as the 34 team, it was almost as good. Venice played a year and a half, and they had a 5-12 team in 1913. And then Vernon, which played in 1919, that team, the manager was Vinegar Bill Essex, who was a longtime scout for the Southern California for the Yankees. And that was their best team. And it had people like Chet Chadbourne, Johnny Mitchell, Bob Musil, Stump Eddington. And on pitchers, they had the famous Weezer Dell and Art Fromm, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that takes us through just California, because this is California baseball. Portland and Seattle were in the league, and they had some great teams, but that is not what we're getting into on a California baseball.
Thanks, Carlos. I'm telling you, he just skimmed over the top. I mean, he gave you the top ones, but I want to impart on, especially you Easterners and Midwesterners, Pacific Coast League. I moved here when I was 15, and it was big-time baseball. And I think that we'd have been better off if the Pacific Coast League had become the third major league. But there's not time to talk about that. We're running out of time, so I'm just going to talk about one segment of Padre history, or San Diego history, between 1900 and 1930. And that, the San Diego Bears were a great team. How do you like their mascot? I'm not sure that's a bear or a man in a bear suit. I never figured that one out. But what happened in 1912 and 1913, California Winter Leagues were the baseball's first integrated leagues. So black teams would come out, and Rube Foster brought out his Leland Giants out of Chicago. Well, in 1912, transportation, I haven't discussed this, but transportation was a big problem out in the West. And they just weren't getting enough competition up in L.A. So Rube Foster's Chicago American Giants spent the winter in San Diego, and they played 24 games. Now, you probably can't see this. This is my idea of audiovisual. I don't even have a cell phone. They're terrible cartoons. They're elitist. They're racist. Here, you can pass that around if you want. They're just awful. And of course, Rube is portrayed as a monkey. Well, what happened is, I'm going to read a few things here. By the end of their stay in San Diego, the Union reported, the American Giants are the only players in Southern California that have really caused the locals to extend themselves to the limit and cause any doubts as to who's who and why. Okay. On March the 23rd in 1913, this was written in the San Diego Union. In after years, those of us who will hold berths on the inside circuit can turn pages back through dusty memories and tell the newcomers to San Diego that once upon a time in San Diego, there was real baseball. And right here it should be written, the aforesaid Giants played ball of the highest caliber, and that their work was comparable with major league teams. Every time the Bears and Giants met at Athletic Park, it was a battle. Every run and every play was important. Black baseball played a very important role in San Diego. That was one of the few teams that we were willing to go pay to watch them play. And as I went through and found these old newspaper articles, and you see how the attitude changes toward these black ball players. And they played hard against each other, but in the end, they really had developed a great mutual understanding. Now, Rube Foster, I don't know how many of you know John Holloway. And all the work he did in the Negro Leagues. And I love this quote that John wrote. White baseball had never seen anyone quite like Rube Foster. He was Chrissy Mathewson, John McGraw, Connie Mack, Al Spaulding, and Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Great pitcher, manager, owner, league czar, league organizer and czar all rolled into one. So I think we'll just move on because we're running out of time. Angus, I've got to read this about you. I mean, this guy is something. Will Bishop, writing in the Journal of the Early Baseball, who reviewed baseball, Journal of the Early Game, this is what he wrote. In terms of readability and popular appeal, the contribution comes closest to McDougall's work on Fowler is Angus McFarland's Baseball Goes East, the 1876 San Francisco Centennial's Magical Mystery Tour. Writing with an eye toward capturing the cultural zeitgeist of American Centennial, as chronicled, the aptly named Centennial's crisscross baseball journey. McFarland gives a fascinating snapshot of the period. Human detail, like the close quarters of the 19th century rail travel that guarantee traveling companions would either be best friends or worst enemies for life, enliven McFarland's subject and make the article worth reading for the armchair historian or the academic. Now, does a magical mystery tour, I mean, kind of corny, huh? Well, he is kind of corny. Angus and his good friend Ken Martone, they grew up in Haight-Ashbury, and they had the Summer of Love. Are anybody here old enough to remember that, or some of you may have been there? When they had it, he was one of the official speakers up in San Francisco talking about the Summer of Love. So why don't you talk about the trip back to the East Coast, Angus, and cut it short, man.
Okay, this is like speed dating. I'm coming around for the third round. Okay, in the summer of 1876, 12 of San Francisco's best baseball players boarded an eastbound train, and that was it. What happened that summer is one of baseball's greatest lost and forgotten achievements. On June 25th, after a big send-off, the San Francisco Centennials, as they called themselves, were on their way to Philadelphia to play in a baseball tournament as part of the nation's centennial celebration. As they crossed the continent, they planned to play baseball at various towns and cities. Up to then, there had been four well-documented baseball tours when the team would travel far from home for an extended period of time. And I've listed on the left-hand corner the teams and what they did. Until 2013, nobody knew about the San Francisco Centennials or their remarkable summer of 1876. That was when I found in the New York Clipper, a weekly 19th century sporting publication, an end-of-year summary of the Centennials' 1876 season. This gem was a bare-bones list of their 32 road games, dates, locations, opponents, and scores. None of this was ever reported in San Francisco's newspapers, neither during nor after. To the world then and to history now, it was as though it had never happened, that the Centennials had never existed. Using the Clipper's information, I was able to recreate the Centennials' historic achievement. They left San Francisco by train on June the 25th, playing their first playing destination being Omaha, Nebraska. And I've drawn their cross-country route with some emoji help for the visuals. You would think that San Francisco's all-star baseball team would receive all-star accommodations. I don't know anything about the tour's financing, but apparently it was a very low-budget affair. They traveled in steerage class. On the way to Omaha, they endured eight horrible days passing through alien landscapes at an average speed of 10 miles per hour. Packed like sardines, they began to smell like sardines. They battled boredom, sensory overload, and sleep deprivation. They crossed mountains and experienced never in their lifetimes triple-digit heat on the skillet flat and frying pan hot Nevada desert and Great Plains. Finally, arriving in Omaha 1,800 miles later, San Francisco's finest must have been teetering on the brink of madness. The benignly alien landscape of the past week was now downright malevolent. All hell was breaking loose around them. A massive, giant, multi-state supercell was throwing tornadoes, torrential rain, flash floods, and 7-inch hail at our boys. Alien landscapes indeed. After losing their July 4th game, they enjoyed a leisurely pace of 5 games in the next 12 uneventful days, playing in Davenport, Chicago, Milwaukee on their way to Detroit. While in Detroit, they witnessed a Northern Lights display that was seen from New England through the Midwest. Toto, how much more alien can this landscape become? Now it was gut check time. They would play 12 games in 15 days in 10 cities. For these weekend warriors, back home 12 games was an entire season, a season that lasted months, not days. At one stretch, the Railroad Warriors would play 6 games in 6 days in 6 different cities. The heat and humidity were killing the Bay Area weather wimps. Nighttime low temperature was hotter than San Francisco's daytime high temperature and the humidity. At one point, they lost 7 in a row. Fatigue and injuries and heat and humidity reduced the 12-man squad to 8 men on a couple of occasions, necessitating bringing in local talent to field the team. But the long, strange trip ended on August 1st.
Excuse me, Angus. It never rains in California, but it's raining. We got in about close to 7 innings, and we're going to have to call the game. But Carlos has a couple things he'd like to say, and then it's over, because I know they want others to come in. So, Carlos?
I just want to talk about African-Americans playing in baseball in California prior in the 19th century. I've found 22 players who played in integrated baseball in the state of California in the 1900s. And one, Eddie Smith, played 12 seasons, and Horace Wiles played 9 seasons. They had the Trilbys that played in L.A., and they had a number of players. So what happened is the Civil War generation gave way to apparently the Jim Crow generation. But in the 19th century, African Americans were allowed to play in California baseball, and they did. And that's the only thing I want to say to put a point on.
Thank you, because I agree. And thank you. And thank you very much for listening. We didn't come close to covering all we wanted to. But thank you very much. It really was wonderful to be here.
Thanks a lot.